and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tinellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax.
This episode is brought to you by HarperCollins Publishers Australia.
Kim Locke is an internationally published, best-selling author of five novels that includes Peace, Love and Khaki Socks, Like I Can Love, The Three of Us and The Other Side of Beautiful. Living in regional South Australia with her family, Kim's writing has appeared in Kill Your Darlings, The Guardian, Daily Life and The Sydney Morning Herald, amongst other publications. Earlier this month, Kim's latest novel, The Fancies, was published by HarperCollins Australia. An irresistibly funny, big-hearted, sharply observed novel about the stories we tell, the stories we believe, and the stories we make into reality, irrespective of their truth. With punchy dialogue and a cast of wonderfully depicted characters, I was quickly drawn into the fictional town of Port Kingerton and raced through the pages to try and uncover the decades-old mystery the townsfolk were so desperate to keep hidden. This is the first of Kim's novels I've read, but listeners, it certainly won't be the last. So it is with great pleasure I welcome Kim to the podcast today. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Claudine. Thanks so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so glad to have you. And wow, what a book. An absolutely delightful read from start to finish, Kim.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That means a lot.
The setting, the characters, the dialogue, the suspense, all made for one heck of a page-turning read. I wondered if you could tell us more about the story and where you drew your inspiration from.
Oh, thank you. That's a great question. You know, this novel has been kind of a long time in the making, although I probably say that about all of my novels. But this one sort of came to me very slowly. And when I say very slowly, I mean it wasn't until each page that I wrote that I knew what was actually going to happen. So a couple of years ago, I moved back to my hometown after 20 years away. And a few years prior to that is when I got the seed for this story. I had the idea of what was it going to be like to move home after being away for so long. And so this novel is about a woman who moves back to her hometown, very tiny little town on the coast, after 20-something years away, and she's coming back very reluctantly. She's very desperate. She's very out of time because when she left, she was just 17 and she swore she would never, ever go back of her own free will. She's just out of her second stint in prison. So she's had a lot happen to her in the past 20 years. And obviously, I didn't return to my hometown under the same circumstances. I haven't been in prison and I came back very happily. But writing this novel was my way of exploring some of those really bizarre teenage angsts, plural, if that's a word, that was coming up in me because I left when I was 19, very happily. I left to go and live with my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband. He was in the military, and so we moved all over Australia, and then he retired and we finally came back. But I found myself wondering, what's it going to be like? You know, is it going to be like being 19 again? What if I run into people from high school? You know, there's sort of all this confected drama started playing in my head. Spoiler alert, nothing happened when I came back. It's not that big a deal. People don't care about you as much as you think they're going to care. So that's sort of where the germ of this story came from, watching the way the mind just makes things up. And so I really sort of injected all of that into this book, I think you could say. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Just wonderful. And I'm going to say to you that I'm unashamedly a fan of Abigail. She was by far my favourite character. She's the no holds barred, no bullshit character that comes striding back into town and starts all the tongues wagging. But she's harbouring some deep trauma, some intense psychological scars that being back in her hometown for the first time in over 20 years, as you say, brings bubbling straight up to the surface. So, Kim, how did you get inside Abigail's head? And was there any particular research you needed to do to bring her character alive onto the page?
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear you say that. Thank you, because I actually really struggled with Abigail to get to know her in the beginning. She was very closed off to me when I started to write her, and I sort of found that in the beginning I actually really didn't like her. I'm not sure why, but she wouldn't come through to me, and I was really struggling with it. And two conversations with two friends really helped me. One was with a friend who reminded me of the character Beth in Yellowstone. I don't know if you know that TV series, but she's this very, very fierce, very unapologetic character. And so I realized that when I was first writing Abigail, she was constantly apologizing for herself, and it made her seem just too vulnerable in a way that I couldn't get on board with. So straight away, I took all that sense of apology away from her and made her have a lot of conviction in who she was, and that changed. And another was a conversation that I had with a writer friend. His name's Les, and he suggested that I write a journal from her perspective at night, as though I'm her, just how she feels. And I did that for something like 3 nights, and that made such a difference, and I was able to get back into the character. So for a long time in the early days, I did struggle with her because I didn't know her, and I actually thought that I didn't like her. But I think in hindsight, it wasn't that I didn't like her, it's that I was scared of her. Yeah. I was scared of making her who she really was, which is very bold and unapologetic, a little bit defensive. So I just found her hard to get on board with. But now I really love her, and I actually really respect her. Mm. So luckily the tables turned, but it took me a while to get there.
Yeah. As you say, Abigail had two recent stints in prison. And obviously we come to know Abigail and the reasons why she's behaved the way she has, and, you know, what led to her imprisonment. Things that we don't know, obviously, when we first meet her. She has some really interesting things to say about bureaucracy, about politicians, and about women being in prison, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. So to expand on your previous question about what research I did, I actually put some feelers out to some support networks for women who've been imprisoned, and the Women's Justice Network very kindly put me in touch with a woman named Frances who has been to prison, and she very generously shared with me some of her experience because having not been to prison myself, obviously it's not my lived experience, and I wanted to know not so much what it's like to be in prison, because that's not really the scope of this novel, but more what it feels like for women when they come out, you know, how that affects their lives. I did some research about women in prison, and the numbers really shocked me to know that our incarceration rates are going up even though our crime levels are coming down. Was quite shocking to learn, I think, because, you know, I've lived in this little bubble of privilege where I just assumed prison was somewhere that only people who'd done something really, really wrong went. But actually that's not the case at all. So I think prison is inextricably political. It's a political system. And the more I learned about it and the more I spoke to people, the more I realized that it's not just a social issue. It's political. So I think Abigail's angry, maybe, and that's why that comes through.
Yeah, it absolutely comes through. And she says some gold gems of lines. You know, she had a conversation with Nate the vet, and what she did wasn't particularly, yes, wrong, but not, you know, something that you would necessarily equate with a prison sentence. But she says something like, once you're in the system, all odds are stacked against you.
You're in it. And that is so true. The majority of people in prison are re-offenders. The people who have been to prison before. So I think she says in the book, somebody says, if prison succeeds at anything at all, it's in making it easier to go back. And that was something that I thought was really quite distressing, because obviously it's supposed to be rehabilitation, but that's in reality very much not the case. And sending her to jail was quite a task. I spoke to some lawyers and I spoke to some police, and because obviously I wanted, she needed a crime to commit that is going to give her a prison sentence, but it also really mattered to me how readers were going to judge her in terms of what she did. So I needed something that would put her in jail, but also wasn't going to make her somebody, you know, completely unlikable. You know, obviously she couldn't do something really, really violent. I'm trying not to go down spoiler road here. but yeah, so that was quite a challenge in itself.
Yeah, I can only imagine. But I think you pulled it off very well.
Thank you.
Port Kingerton, as I said in my introduction, is a fictional town at the most southern end of South Australia. You set the scene so perfectly with this town. It's isolated, it's rugged, wild nature, almost claustrophobic in its isolation from other towns. So, Kim, was there any significance to setting the book there apart from its geographical isolation?
Yeah, it's funny. I've had people ask me, what town is it based on? And then they list little coastal towns that they know that sound like it could be that town. You know, it's very obviously for those familiar with the geography of South Australia, there is a crayfishing town at the very southern tip of the state called Port Macdonnell, and that's Port Mac to the locals. It's only about half an hour away from where I live, and I absolutely love it there. It's such a beautiful spot. I've always loved it. We go down there for fish and chips. We go to the beach. So obviously this Port Kingerton is not Port Macdonnell and the characters are not the same. But I wanted somewhere that was isolated, that had that really classic small town feel, because there's nothing I love more than a small Aussie town for characters who are larger than life. And their world is, you know, the edges of their town. And so what happens in that town matters to them so much because it is their entire world. And so that's purely why I chose this location. I wanted somewhere removed and remote and cold, but obviously it had to be fictional.
Yeah, indeed. Now, to say that this town was characterized by a deep familial rivalry would be an understatement. And it seemed that the 24-year ceasefire between the Fancies and the Brams took very little to erupt once more. Can you tell me more about that and why this was important to the story?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I mean, that does happen in small towns. You tend to have the family or the families that are sort of sovereign. You know, they've been there for many generations, and they're the ones that people look up to without realizing they're looking up to them, or they're the ones that people feel resentful about the fact that they have to look up to them. And, you know, you often hear rumors when you visit small towns. As writers, I think we pay a lot of attention. We tend to be the people listening in coffee shops and things like that. So you hear stories, and, you know, being from a small country town myself, you get to hear the gossip. And sort of building on what I was saying before about how a small town becomes very convinced that their world is the whole world, I think these old rivalries also are perhaps simply no more than that. They're just believing these grudges into existence all the time. And so I think it was important in this story that is about Abigail fearing what's going to happen to her on her return. It was important for me to mirror that in the town, and that they're just choosing to believe this grudge against each other, when really it's nothing more than hot air. If they would just stop believing it, it would stop existing effectively.
Indeed. Kim, as with many wonderful novels, the wit and humour they contain often reveal deeper issues, and this is no less true of The Fancies. At the heart of this novel is a 24-year secret which almost destroyed a young girl's life, and many people seem to turn a blind eye to what was really going on. So is this something you specifically set out to explore in this novel, and why?
Yeah, again, to not go into spoiler territory, but there was, when I had the idea for this novel several years ago about writing a woman returning to her hometown, there was a story that I saw on the news about something, a cold case from the 1990s in WA that had just been solved. And it was, I think, 30 years old, from the 90s. Yeah, I was about 30 years old. And it really struck me and sort of stuck with me what had happened. I have to be vague to not go into spoilers here. But to answer your question, yes, it was something I really wanted to explore, but I had to do so in a way that honoured this story, which is sort of about believing things that aren't necessarily true. So this is something that had happened to her, but it had sort of happened almost in a way that you could argue wasn't to her, but it had affected her so deeply, and she was unable to move on from it because of the things that she'd believed and had been told to her about herself. And so she'd continue to play it out, really, until the present day when the story was set. She was continuing to sort of persecute herself almost unconsciously and believe these things about herself that weren't necessarily true.
Yes, indeed. Now, talking about believing things that aren't necessarily true, I think just, you know, elaborating on things we've already said, but you've captured the essence of small town attitudes and the tendency for hyperbole and misconstruing events, the gossips who boldly exaggerate something that they've seen. If you'll allow me and indulge me to quote Abigail, who says, "Tell me more about the crap people who spin when they're afraid. Explain to me how a group of people, all believing their own terrified bullshit, can make a reality out of nothing. Better yet, explain that to all the witches they burned." And I absolutely loved that line. Do you think these attitudes are confined to small towns, or is this just a microcosm of society at large?
Oh, I think it probably is a microcosm of society at large. I think it's probably something that humans have learnt to do over many hundreds, if not thousands of years, as we become perhaps bigger in population and more connected and more mobile. I mean, we tell stories. It's what we've always, always done. But this tendency to persecute and to other, I don't think it's something that is inherent to human nature. I think it's perhaps something that we've learnt to do as we maybe become more afraid or more disconnected from each other or disconnected from ourselves, without getting too deep there. But yeah, I think it's absolutely something that's not limited to small towns. I think we do it on little scale, and we do it on big scale, and we even sort of did it in the last few years. I think, you know, the way we sort of got very scared and isolated, and nobody knew what was really going on, even though we all wished we knew what was going on. You know, it sort of changed from moment to moment. The truth became very shifting, a sort of shifting yeah. thing. One day we believe something, and the next day we believe something else. So that I was writing the book during the pandemic, so I think that was probably really sticking in my mind as well, the way it's hard to know sometimes what's true despite our best intentions and our desire to really believe the right thing and what's true.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that the town were too quick to judge Abigail, too easy to believe the worst in her? And would her life have turned out differently if not for the town's collective judgment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think on one level, yes. I mean, if she was embraced 24 years ago and supported, her life would have been completely different. But instead, she was sort of scapegoated and persecuted in a way that women have been over the centuries. I think, you know, the novel obviously has a very unashamed feminist slant, but I think that just comes out of my writing, being a feminist myself. I don't intend for it to be overly feminist, but it's just the way I see the world. So it informs the things that I say. And so I think that surprised even me in the way this book became about misogyny, perhaps, that is just focused on sort of that almost witch hunt feeling, finger pointing a woman and making her the reason for everything being difficult for other people. I think that just sort of came through without me even really intending it to.
Abigail's relationship with her mother was interesting, to say the least. I think there was, you know, lack of communications, and it seemed to characterise and inflame their relationship, I think. Was this something you intended to explore, or was this more a product of their characters?
I actually was really surprised by the way their dynamic is between Abigail and her mother. When I was writing the first chapter, it's probably not a spoiler to say that she arrives home and her mother slams the door in her face. You know, that's the end of the first yeah. chapter, about page 4 or 5. I didn't see that coming. You know, I write, she says, "Hi, Mum," and then next minute her mum slams the door in her face, and I was left going, okay. Didn't think that was going to happen. I thought that her mum would be excited to see her and supportive. So the sort of almost unspoken animosity between the two of them, it was something that I had to get to the bottom of myself. But, of course, I realised that would make sense to Abigail's character, that she's felt unsupported. But it's sort of her own doing. She tends to rail against bars that aren't now there and haven't always been there. And so I think that her mum often feels very exasperated by that she just can't get through to her, and she just genuinely doesn't know what to do with her. And obviously when Abigail returns, even though she's in her very late 30s, she's 39, for her mum it feels like she's 15 all over again as well. So both of them almost go straight back to that teenage dynamic and yeah. have to work.
Yeah, so interesting. Kim, if there was one thing you'd like readers to take away from this book, what would it be?
I really just want them to be entertained. I think in our discussion we've made it sound quite dark, but But it's my hope that it's actually a very light-hearted novel, that it really just pokes fun at our human ability to persecute ourselves. I just really want them to have a really entertaining reading experience, because I think we all need that right now, to just be taken out of ourselves for a few hours and to laugh at somebody else's made-up problems. And that's what I really want for readers. I love nothing more than a book that completely immerses you in a really entertaining story. And so that's what I would really hope to give back to readers in this instance.
Oh, well, if I've given listeners that impression, let me correct it now. I laughed out loud in so many spots with this book. Yes, despite those sort of deeper themes, it was an absolutely thrilling and page-turning read, and I loved all of the characters. I loved those larger-than-life, small-town characters. It almost sounds like an oxymoron there, but they were absolutely delightful. I loved being in Port Kingerton for the time that I was there, and I thoroughly enjoyed that read, and I'm sure listeners will too.
Thank you so much. And it is really funny. It actually made me laugh so much, and I don't know where that came from. So I just really love that about this novel, about how funny it is.
Yeah, brilliant. Kim, you might know that there are many aspiring authors who listen to this podcast. So given all of your experiences to date, I wondered if you had any tips to offer about writing or the publishing process.
Oh, that's a great question. You know, there's so much really good writing advice that's almost become cliche because it's so good. Obviously, read more than you write, and read what you love and work out why you love it. The other thing that I would offer is, don't be scared of editing. I love editing. That is my favorite part of the process. I actually find the initial draft quite difficult, but once I can edit it, I feel like that's when I really shine. So sometimes editing can be scary, but so I would say, don't be scared, embrace editing, see it as an opportunity to make your work better. Editing can only ever be a good thing.
Oh, such great advice. Thank you so much for sharing that, Kim.
You're welcome.
Are you working on something else at the moment?
I am. I have another contract, so I'm very excited about that. But now that the fancy's out, I'm going to take just a little bit of downtime and rest. Because I realise I haven't actually done that for over 10 years now. So yes, I'm definitely working on something new, and it's in its very embryonic stages, and I'm just so excited to see where it goes at this point.
Fantastic. And Kim, if listeners wanted to learn more about you and your books, where can they find you?
So I have a website. It's kimlock.com.au. It has all the information about my books and a contact form to get in touch with me. And I'm also on Facebook, Kim Lock Author. They can find me that way.
Brilliant. That's wonderful. Kim, what a joy it was for me to discover The Fancies. I absolutely loved it, and I'm looking forward to delving into your backlist. I wish you every success with this book, and thank you so very much for joining me on Talking Aussie Books today.
Oh, thanks, Claudine. It's been absolutely wonderful. I'm so happy to be here.
That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetonellis.com, via Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading!